supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Two inmates at Philadelphia's Federal Detention Center are suing to overturn a policy that prevents some of their loved ones from visiting them as they await trial. As WHYY's Aaron Mozell reports, it may impact hundreds at the Center City facility.
Under the center's policy, only immediate family can visit an inmate during the pretrial phase of a case, which can last months, even years. That includes parents of all flavors, siblings, spouses, and children. It doesn't include boyfriends and girlfriends, and by extension, it also excludes children if the kids' parents aren't married. Ben Geffen is a staff attorney with the Public Interest Law Center, one of the parties bringing what's hoped to be a class-action lawsuit against the prison's warden. He says the policy is unconstitutional.
People who are in the federal detention center who are actually serving a sentence after being convicted have a less restrictive visitation policy. They're allowed to have more distant relatives and to have friends who are unrelated come in and visit them. This is about the only thing I can think of in the criminal law where you actually gain new rights after you're convicted and sentenced.
Dana Walter has a 2-year-old son with Keith Campbell, one of the suit's plaintiffs. She says it's hard not being able to visit the man she's been with for more than a decade, especially before trial.
They're just kind of sitting in a no man's land wondering what's going on, and they have no support.
On paper, the policy does allow for exceptions on a case-by-case basis. 2 days a year, the prison also offers inmates the opportunity to marry their significant others. The detention center spokesman did not immediately respond to a request for comment. He has said the policy is in place to prevent the flow of illegal drugs into the prison. Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
The State Department of Health remains on track to launch Pennsylvania's medical marijuana program next year. And toward that end, the department this summer announced the winners of 12 grower processors and 27 dispensary permits. The 2018 target date could be delayed, though, as dozens of losing applicants have filed appeals challenging the denial of permits. Joining me with more is Wallace McKelvey of Penn Live. Wallace, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
It's a pleasure.
First off, describe your efforts to shed more light on the permitting process.
Yes. I mean, there are kind of two parallel tracks that I've taken so far on via right-to-know requests. One of them is to get unredacted versions of the applications, and the other is to actually get the identities, that's the name, the job title, and the department of the panel that actually scored the applications. They were the ones who ultimately kind of led to the awarding of these permits, who won and who lost.
The department did release apparently thousands of pages of application materials, though you're saying they were redacted.
Some of the applications were so heavily redacted that we don't even know the names of who funded these enterprises, who the leadership is. And in one case, one of the applicants actually redacted their own name.
Though in spite of that, we do know some familiar names, the son of former Philadelphia Inquirer owner H.F. Lenfest, an XFL football player, and even former Environmental Secretary John Hanger.
Yes, and that gives you a sense of how important this industry is, and in at least from my vantage point, how important transparency is. We're talking right now about nationwide a $6.7 billion industry that could, according to one trade research association, it could reach $20 billion in the next 4 years. And with all these very influential people behind the scenes, there is a need to know how the process actually works.
Then how does the department defend not releasing the names of those who vetted the applicants?
Yeah, so this panel, which as far as I understand is an interdisciplinary group of people, probably state employees, did not include leadership at the Department of Health as far as we understand. And the Department of Health, their argument is that if they release the names of these people, that they would be subject to a wave of influence peddling, and that they may face phone calls from applicants, pressure, may be open to persuasion to try to increase the scores of the applicants, which is a fair argument, but the actual scoring period is over, at least for the first phase, and they still haven't released the names of this panel. From what I've been told, it's general practice in other states to make that information public once the permits are awarded and once their work is done.
Of course, the intent is to provide relief for patients, and toward that end, what avail do those who could benefit from medical marijuana have between now and when the program is ultimately launched?
Well, the first grouping of people who are eligible for medical marijuana, these would be children. And there is a program that allows their parent or their legal guardian, if they can, to procure the medicine across state lines. And that process is already in the works. There have already been approvals granted to patients on that front. The current timetable has the actual full implementation, having access to this medicine for eligible patients next year, possibly as soon as the spring or early summer. And best we can tell, that is on track, although the wild card will be what happens in court.
Wallace, thanks so much for bringing us up to date.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Wallace McKelvey of Penn Live. When it comes to recovery, relapse is often a reality because long after drugs are out of a person's system, the underlying addiction remains, and the stakes are higher now given the sharp rise in overdose deaths. WHYY's Alana Gordon reports that there are better tools to treat addiction, but they require a new mindset.
Nate Robinson remembers that moment in the 90s when he met up with someone who had heroin.
So I said, give me a snort of that, man. Give me a snort of that. I said, oh, man, this is good.
And even better mixed with other drugs. Robinson spent the years since chasing and escaping that high. Because at some point, as happens, that high turns to dependency. And then full-blown addiction.
I was in denial. I never thought I had a problem. And I always maintained a job and always, you know, did what I had to do. So, but I looked bad. You know, I lost all the weight. You know, I've been a slim dude all my life anyway. But now I'm done. I mean, I'm burnt.
Robinson went to treatment, to rehabs, cycling in and out. Last spring, things were looking especially good. He went inpatient to a place in West Philly for a month.
And I could do good when I go in rehab. I buy into everything and I say what I'm going to do.
But shortly after he got out, he relapsed again. Robinson isn't alone because when it comes to addiction and recovery, relapse is really, really common. And not just for opioids. In Philadelphia, Dr. Rose Julius sees this all the time, especially in reviewing the thousands of Medicaid claims, as a main medical officer at Community Behavioral Health.
So what we know definitively right now is that for people who entered detox in 2015, more than half relapsed.
Not only that, Julius also says only a small portion of people who started treatment for substance use, like 20%, continued with treatment after that initial episode. Her agency has started trying to better study what happens to people and where the treatment system can improve. For example, despite the critical role of medication-assisted therapies in the recovery process, Julius says the city currently has 1,000 open slots available for buprenorphine-aided treatment. She says addiction services have long been fragmented and separate from the rest of medical care. So part of that is better educating medical providers and the public and improving the ways people can connect with those services. Julius says the biggest shift is moving away from the view that relapse is a moral failure or something that's inevitable.
It does not mean that you have to live with this sort of negative albatross around you forever. It just means that you have a condition that you need to properly manage.
The reasons behind relapse are complex and nuanced and vary from person to person. But Julius says the key is treating addiction like you would any other chronic condition. Just like diabetes or asthma, it needs to be managed with ongoing supports and treatment long term?
You know, I treat lots of people with addiction, and the most common thing I hear when people relapse and we talk through, well, what do you think happens? You often hear that someone stopped doing the things that were keeping them in recovery. So they would stop attending support groups, stop attending treatment, forget about the things that they were doing proactively that was helping to support them.
As for Nate Robinson, he's well aware of the realities and the risks. The week before we spoke, he overdosed. Someone saved him with naloxone. Robinson says he's trying something new now, buprenorphine treatment. But that's just one part.
Yeah, I want to be clean next year this time. I've said that. You understand me? Of course. But you have to do some things, and you have to be true to it. Trust me, it's some work involved with staying clean. Because if not, you're going to relapse, You can go in, get clean, and you're going to relapse. When you come out of here, you got to do some work.
For him, that work also involves getting back to meetings and to church, to volunteering and singing.
I've had some good days. I've had some hills to climb. I've had some. That's my mission. That's what I like to do. I have some gifts that God has given me that I need to be using. And lonely nights.
Alana Gordon, WHYY News.
But when I look around.
You can hear more on the science of relapse this week on The Pulse, tomorrow morning at 9, and again Sunday at noon on WHYY-FM. There is some movement in Harrisburg toward resolving the state budget impasse, now extending into a fourth month, though that movement is not based on bipartisan accord. Joining me with the latest is WHYY's Katie Meyer. And Katie, Democratic Governor Tom Wolf has cut through the finger-pointing and arm-twisting by taking unilateral steps to balance a portion of the budget. What are the details?
Governor Wolf yesterday announced that he's going to securitize future revenue from the State Liquor Control Board. Democrats seemed to know about it. A lot of the Republicans were blindsided and unhappy that he was doing this. This was sort of a very decisive speech from a governor who's not always too combative. He said he was drawing a line in the sand, that he was going to take things into his own hands and manage the state's finances. It wasn't really that much of a line in the sand. It was along the lines of something that we've been expecting him to do, just in terms of getting some sort of revenue to tide the state over. But nevertheless, it was an unexpected move.
How long does it tide the state over?
Well, it's unclear. We've got a $2.2 billion deficit per the IFO, the Independent Fiscal Office. This would give us $1.25 billion exactly, and that's upfront, and then we would pay that back over a number of years, the LCB would. Wolf has talked about also paring down some of the state's complement of workers through attrition. He's talked about, you know, saving some money in other ways, but we don't have all the specifics. And, you know, $1.2 billion, while it will definitely keep money flowing, you know, help our general fund avoid hitting zero again like it did last month, I think people are still very concerned that a structural deficit would remain if we didn't get more additional money.
Fair to say this is analogous to putting a Band-Aid on a gaping wound?
It certainly seems to be. Wolf said he wants negotiations to continue between the House and Senate to get that revenue in there that's still missing. House and Senate Republican leaders said it cools negotiations a little bit. They're both regrouping after sort of a disastrous meltdown in their own negotiations right now, so they don't really have a path forward at this point, but they seemed open to continuing. We just don't know what form that's going to take.
Let's put that call for negotiation in the context of the House not due back in session for 2 weeks, and the Senate has no scheduled return date.
Yeah, that's true. They had tried several different ways to, you know, get some revenue to close this budget hole. And, you know, one after another, these attempted deals just melted down. And so they left Governor Wolf again, you know, kind of changed the direction with his own announcement of securitizing liquor. And, you know, I think a lot of lawmakers were very frustrated, very disheartened when they left Harrisburg yesterday.
Has Governor Wolf changed his mind about the importance of a natural gas severance tax?
He has not. The natural gas severance tax got a really significant blow yesterday when, unexpectedly, House Democrats called it up for a vote. They tried to get it discharged from the committee where it's been stuck. They tried to get a vote to get it considered on the floor, and that vote failed pretty decisively. Even, you know, some Democrats didn't vote for it. It seemed like a little bit of a death knell for the severance tax for now, but Governor Wolf still says he wants to see that. He thinks that's the best path forward. He wants the Republicans to discharge it from committee. They say there's no will to do that. They don't want a severance tax. So that's kind of where it stands right now.
Theoretically possible that we could get to next June 30th with some semblance of the status quo?
It's difficult to know what the actual impact is going to be. The state can limp along with just the money that Governor Wolf plans to appropriate from that liquor securitization for a while. I mean, our payments are going to be made. Money, again, as they always say, is still coming in. So the situation's not like the state's going to shut down anytime soon. The problem is, you know, the structural deficit probably grows if that's the case, if there's no new revenue. That certainly seemed to be the sense I got from any of the fiscal officers I talked to. So, yes, the state can limp along. Will the state limp along? I mean, unclear. There certainly is some will to get more revenue, to, you know, use a different option to keep the state running for the next year, but it's all up in the air right now.
Katie Meyer, thanks so much for your answers, and as always, many questions remain.
Yes, indeed.
WHYY's Katie Meyer on Newsworks Tonight. The String Theory Charter School occupies an 8-floor office building in Center City, Philadelphia. The first 7 floors are classrooms, and on the 8th, they're cooking up an experiment, as WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt explains.
The first batch was a little curly, so these are coming out really nicely.
Lisa Jane Russell is a food stylist.
Basically, I am a makeup artist for food.
In August, she began working out of a test kitchen on the top floor of String Theory Charter School. And she got a pair of new apprentices, senior Raven Buckhalter and junior Caitlin Stone. While the students roll dough, Russell gets to save dough. She doesn't pay a dime for this brand new space.
It is absolutely free.
Sounds like a pretty sweet deal.
I know, right? Merry Christmas to me.
Welcome to Particle Space, String Theory's new service for startups. Small companies get free office space. In exchange, they either design a class for String Theory students or hire them as interns. Co-founder Jason Corsanini oversees the 4-campus charter network.
We definitely needed some, you know, some different experiences and more sophisticated experiences than just, you know, I took AP Physics.
String Theory wants to expand its network and sees Particle Space as a way to do that. The organization believes it can license the idea and sell it to other high schools and perhaps even universities. With that revenue may come opportunities to add more schools in more states. Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
Over his 50-year-long career, musician Paul Jost has written more than 400 songs. He's played drums, harmonica, and guitar on dozens of albums, and he's taught music to students from elementary school through college. But it wasn't until 2011 that the Vineland, New Jersey native decided to focus his talents on singing. Jost recently spoke with WHYY-TV's Friday Arts program about finding his voice and helping singers of all ages to find theirs.
I got rhythm. I got music.
I think we all sing a little bit. You know, we all sing in the shower. It's a great thing. It's a really great connector.
Don't need no more.
I try to sing music the most honest way that I can. I want to be organic. I want to be in the moment. I'm not shy about being vulnerable. I just want to let it be a true expression of what I have to say. And I'm hoping that in that interpretation, that you also hear something of yourself. I want to vibrate that chord that we both share as human beings. How old was I when I started music? I mean, I started right from the beginning. I don't remember not being in music. Well, I do remember at 5 years old asking Santa Claus for a set of drums. And I think playing drums, because it's so physical, that was just a good release. I started playing professionally when I was 12 years old. I would be at weddings or something, and I'd ask my mom, you think I could sit in? And she'd say, all they could say is no. Just go ask. And sometimes they'd say, no, get away. And then sometimes they'd say, yeah, go ahead. And I'd be so happy to play. I had the opportunity to do a reimagining of Bruce Springsteen's iconic album, Born to Run. When I was asked to do it, it was in a jazz context because it was for a jazz festival. So when I listened to the music of Born to Run, the thing that intrigued me the most was the lyric. I did different treatments of presenting that lyric in a little bit different way. There's nothing that pleases me more than finishing something and somebody saying, I never thought of the song that way. You know, it's a live interpretation, and it's great. I mean, I really had a great time with it. There's a reason why they say music is the universal language, because it is. It strikes these chords that we share, and it's those vibrations. There's something that, like, brings us together. There's plenty of times that I've sung, and my voice just isn't up to snuff. But you find a way to make it work with what you have that day. So it's not like, oh, I can't sing today. It's like, no, I can't sing that way today, but I can sing this way today.
That's musician Paul Jost. To learn more about him, tune into Friday Arts tomorrow evening at 8:30 on WHYY-TV. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.